true for milliliter blood going that way, and I have the tissue is producing 4 milliliters of CO2 per minute. And you can go set up this thing in all algebra kind of way if you want. But basically, you say, oh, wait a minute now. If the blood coming in has 0.48 milliliters of CO2, and the blood leaving has 0.52 milliliters of CO2, how much did each milliliter of blood take up? 0.04. And if it's taking 4 milliliters of CO2 away in a minute, how much blood must it take? If I say that I have, that each milliliter is getting 0.04, and I have 4 milliliters of CO2 per minute flowing away, how many milliliters of blood must there have been?
100.
Complicated, Alex?
100.
100. So I didn't have to think about setting an equation. And if I actually looked at this, the way I answered the question is after I had this drawn, my sketch tells me what the answer is. Now, if you see that on that, that's the way you draw it. That's great. If you see this on that, that's great. In yesterday's card, somebody wrote, when I did the problem with the fish in the tank, I didn't do what you did. I said, oh, you know, it looks like out of each milliliter of solution, the fish is 5 milligrams. And so there are 100 milliliters. You must be eating 500 milliliters. 500 milligrams per minute. Is that right? Of course that's right. Yeah. And there's not one way to do any of these. But really what you've asked yourself in doing this is how much stuff is coming in a minute and how much stuff is going out in a minute. And if you're in a steady state, the amount that comes in per minute has to equal the amount that goes out per minute. Questions about that? Does that make sense? That's too simple-minded. This concept we're going to see over and over and over and over and over again. But the next problem is a little bit different. It says a person inhales 5,000 milliliters of fresh air. There's no carbon dioxide in air. He exhales the same volume of gas which is collected in the bag for 1 minute. This gas contains 5% CO2. How much carbon dioxide is this person producing in a minute? Sketch that the same way I drew that. Then I can do this. I can say, okay, you'll find out that because I'm a respiratory physiologist, that's a lot. That may be something, that might be an endocrine mushroom or a little weight or something like that. And what the problem says is that there's no CO2 coming in from there, there's CO2 going out from here, and that CO2 from here. And so you say, okay, I collected 5,000 milliliters of gas 5% of that was CO2, where did that CO2 have to come from? It had to come from here. It had to come from what? Where was it produced? And how long did it take me to get that 5,000 milliliters? 1 minute. So you don't have to set up a whole lot of fancy kinds of equations. And if you draw a sketch of the problem, the sketch helps you decide what the answer is. Questions about that? Does that make sense? Is that helpful? Is that boring?
No.
Oh, yes it is. Yeah, I did that in high school. What does it tell you? That A and B are in equilibrium. She says that the A and B separate, this side is in equilibrium with that side, maybe. What does the K represent? An equilibrium constant, a reaction constant. All right, so now here's the question. If I add more A to this, what happens? Goes to the right. Everybody's familiar with that, yes? No? Okay, what happens? Okay, so what happens? What happens? Yeah. This is coming. Erase that situation. We have a difference. We take B away. What happens?
Goes to the
left. Alright. That's good. So this is a basic basic inorganic chemistry concept, which we call mass action. And I'm going to put it in a little different form. So here we have, what's that? Circle, or the cell. Here we have, what do you think that is? A pumpkin, because it's Halloween. In the Halloween, starting to see pumpkins. If that was a cell, what is that little thing on top? It's a receptor. Okay. So, that's a receptor. And now, here are some ligands. What is a ligand? Something that... Well, no, a ligand is something that binds the receptor. What that does afterwards is it releases them. So, oxygen is a ligand. Hemoglobin binds the hemoglobin. Thyroid stimulating hormone is a ligand that binds to a receptor on the outside of the cell that causes it to be cell. So, ligand is the thing that's going to bind that to the receptor. So, at any given point, what happens if I... So I've got a population of receptors on here, and this molecule binds there. Okay? What would happen if I decrease the concentration of the molecules that are surrounding that cell? What's going to happen to this ligand? It's going to
be less of it to bind.
There will be less of it to bind the receptor, but we said this one's already bound. So what's going to happen to that one that's already bound? It's going to go back out. So the ligand is reversibly binding, and it's going to go back out. Well, gee, you know what? Here's the receptor. Here's the ligand. We said we put them together. There's a ligand receptor coupling. And if I take away some of one, it comes back. So we're going to see this mass action all over the place in lots of different ways. When we talk about receptors, when we talk about reactions, when we talk about all kinds of things. So we're going to expect to see that all over the place. And that's something you all know, right? Because you all took an inorganic chemistry.
How does it unbind?
Oh, that's good. This is technical chemistry stuff, you see, that I can't really tell you. So you have to ask Kent about these, but in my mind, the way I think about it, is that this is a probabilistic event, and this bonding is a weak binding of intermolecular forces. He might say it's a hydrogen bond or a silicon bond, I don't know, that's chemistry. But in my mind, it's a weak binding. And in my model, when I think about that, the thing that keeps it there is partly that weak binding. But it's also partly all these other like molecules. So what I see is that these guys are kind of pushing this guy and holding it there. And when these guys leave, there's less push. If there's less push, then that comes off. Make sense? Okay. So that's my simple-minded model of how those things work. And we're gonna talk about that when we talk about oxygen, hemoglobin. We're gonna talk about that when we talk about receptors and binding of cells. We're gonna talk about that all. All right. Other questions about that? Now the next page is what we talked about yesterday about regulation. Yesterday we said, if a variable is regulated, what does that mean? And what did we say it meant? It's sensed. So here's our sensor. Here's the variable. Here's our sensor. And that level is then now fed back. This little thing means a comparator. It's rather interesting because this little symbol is derived from before you were born and is what we use as something called an analog computer. There were no numbers, there were just circuits. And so this says, okay, it's going to take this set point, it's going to subtract off this what the sensor sends, and out of that it's going to get an error signal. And then we said in our pictures there's something in between here that we call the controller. The controller is going to make the decision to do whatever it's going to do with the effector. And the effector we decided was your foot in the gas pedal. And that's going to act to bring the regulated variable back toward normal. Now it's very important to recognize that, wait a minute, is it this? Who's, we have the electrical engineer in here? Yeah. Huh? The other times? Let's think about what happens. You tell me what happens. So we're going to go around this loop lots of times. Okay? We're going to start out and we're going to disturb this regulated variable. We're going to make that regulated variable go down from some outside disturbance. And as a result of that, then this sensor value is less, and feedback here is a lot less than the set point. There's an error signal, and the vector veins go up. Okay? And so the next time around, what happens? What happens to the value being sent?
It's going up.
It's greater than it was before. So what happens to this signal? What happens to this error signal? And it's not matching, but it's closer now. So there's still be an error message. And how much is the effector going to act now? Less, because it's getting less of an error signal. And so we're going to go around this loop again. And as a result, that's going to be less of an error signal, and less effector working on this. And so the real question is, how long will it take to come back to the regulated set point? Come back short, very short time or long time? It may, but what happens if the effector changes it too much? If the effector changes it too much, then this goes way up. This is now above the set point. This error message is in the other direction. Okay? And this goes way down, which makes this go down, and you get some sort of an oscillation. Well, the only way it can know how much to do and if it works is what the sensor comes back and sends back in. We have a couple different situations. So let's plot something. Now we're going to plot something against time, so we're just changing something and we're observing something with time. And we're going to say, here's the set point. That's where we want something to be. And here's a regulated variable. So this is a regulated variable. And it starts here, close to there, and we decrease it. And what you told me is what's going to happen is that this is going to start to increase. Now there are several options. One option was, and the way we set it, is this is going to get closer and closer and closer and closer, and every time that we go around that loop, that error message is going to get smaller. So this is going to approach this, but it's never going to quite reach it. In biological systems, that's what happens. The other possibility that we talked about is, all right, it goes down like this, and it overcorrects. And then it goes back down and up and down, and finally it comes back to the center. We don't see that oscillation in biological systems. We see it in lots of other systems. And the other possibility is what Laura wanted to do is say, okay, it's going to come right back here. But we don't see that much in biological systems either. So we're looking at what's called an underdamped system. And the thing that's important to recognize is that this comes very close to where it was initially, but it never quite, for a general rule, it never quite gets there. Why? Because there's always an error signal. There's always a little bit of an error signal. So unless something else changes in the system, and we're going to talk about that in terms of blood pressure later on. We're going to see what might happen to cause blood pressure to drop. Well, maybe the heart isn't pumping. So what's going to happen to do that? In our general scheme of biological control system, we generally say that the system is underdamped. And as a rule of thumb, it's going to come very, very close to where it was. Something else in the system has to change with the disturbance to really bring it back. And then we said, the other day, we said, okay, what is this feed forward thing? And feed forward thing, we said, was anticipation. The anticipatory. That's really when you have this situation where there's some higher level command that's going to send a signal down and get this ready. And one of the things we talked about was with the GI system and the cephalic phase of digestion, where if you smell something, you taste something, you think about food, you turn on some things going on in the stomach and the intestine and the pancreas and other places. And somebody asked, well, okay, so what about the person who works in a restaurant? What happens about the person in the kitchen? Is that person continually getting stuff, getting ready to receive food? The answer is no, because after a while, this higher command center is going to become less sensitive to those smells and other kinds of things. And so it's going to decrease that signal, that anticipation.
Dr. Mordell, would you then not recognize if you were hungry?
Oh, if you're hungry, you would, sure.
But if you were there for a long time and that signal decreased,
the question is, what you're really saying is, if I get hungry, then what I'm going to do is, what's going to happen is I'm going to heighten the awareness of what's around me, and I'm going to plan to eat something, and that's going to fit into the controller to turn those things on. So now let's see, we've talked about the acid heat flow model, we've talked about a reservoir model, we've talked about a control model, we've talked about chemical mass action, we're going to talk about a couple others as we move on. The other thing that we need to really review is something that you talked about in terms of the general model that you made your little diagram about. And that's membrane transport across cell membranes. So tell me about cell membranes.
Receptors,
what's the receptor made out of?
Proteins.
So the proteins in there.
Cholesterol.
some other things in there. Let's think about protein. And when you see that picture, do you see any particular proteins? I mean, what are the proteins doing there?
Transmembrane.
They're transporting. Is that what you said?
I said transmembrane proteins.
Transmembrane protein is going to go from one side of the protein to the other side of the protein, which is very important because then that might carry something. So it's really neat because if it goes across here, it is a transmembrane protein, and it goes across it, and there's a binding site here for something, then, if this binds the site, what might happen to that protein? Change the shape. How can it change shape? What's another word for this membrane? Channel biology. It's a fluid mosaic.
Walk around in there and all move around, stuff like that.
So, if I have this particular carrier, and we didn't show it that way on the diagram the other day, but we put a bunch of these molecules out here, and there aren't that many molecules in here. What's the probability that one of these molecules is going to bind right there? Very high. And then what's happened is that the intermolecular forces within that molecule are going to change, and you'll see a conformational change. And so now that membrane, oh, I know. Let's look at it this way. There it is. This binding site right here. Okay. Let's say it's like this. Like that. Something comes out and binds, shape to shape, just like that. So it may always be changing shape. But if it changes shape, and there's a molecule here that is transforming, it changes shape to there, can the molecule go back out? What would cause it, do you think, to go down into the cell?
A gradient.
Because the energy of that molecule is higher than the energy down here, because there aren't that many of them here, and it comes off and goes in. So in that particular molecule, what will happen if I change the gradient? Same transporter, I change the gradient. So now I have more down here. Then I have here. Which way is that going to carry stuff?
Out.
Is that active transport or passive transport? Passive transport. But you know, a lot of people want to call that facilitated. Why is it facilitated?
It utilizes the protein.
It's not just because
it utilizes the protein, doesn't just go through on its own.
Doesn't just go through on its own. It has to be carried. So it's carrier mediated or facilitated diffusion because it goes along concentration gradient. Okay. Then we talked about some other types of things that in fact the secondary is needed. We talked about glucose and hydrogen and sodium. And we talked about sodium potassium pump. That's a protein too. But we're putting energy into the system. So now we've got a couple different classifications that we can think about. We can think about whether something is hydrophilic or hydrophobic. We can think about whether it's carrier-mediated or not. We can think about whether it requires energy from input to the system or not. And we can end up with a concept map or some sort of a map of all these things. So what we see here is here are two categories. And we have physical categories and we have energy requirements. And we saw that there are two possibilities. You can call them one. There are two possibilities. We have an energy requirement where there's no additional energy required and when there is additional energy required. So we have passive transport and active transport. If we look at passive transport, we see there's diffusion. Well, the same thing. And we said there were two types of diffusion. There's simple diffusion and facilitated diffusion. And what was the requirement to get simple diffusion? The physical requirement is the molecule is limit soluble. So we had stuff that was lipid soluble and stuff that wasn't, that required a carrier. And now we see the carriers are involved with facilitated diffusion, secondary active transport, primary active transport. And the primary active transport, as we talked about the other day, creates a gradient for secondary active transport. So here we have this nice summary of things that's much easier to see the links between than if I added an outline form. Because I'd have to have all of these boxes under energy requirements in an outline and under physical requirements, and I wouldn't see the table together. So it's another purpose of this diagram is wanting to show you again that by using a pictorial information organizer, you can see lots of things and make a lot more links and connections. And the other thing is to summarize what we talked about membrane transport. So we talked about a carrier. Is there any other kind of protein that might go, that's transmembrane protein, that might allow movement through that membrane?
Channel?
A pump. A pump is a particular kind of carrier mediated. It's binding a sodium potassium pump, binding a sodium, or number of sodium, number of potassium, or the
four.
A channel. What's a channel? What does that mean? Of course, water passes through the membrane, water channel. Or if it's other kinds of channels, into the urea, the Mondlane, there was a channel there between the rocket kind of it opens. So what else do you think might go through that channel besides water? What's in what might be in the water would go through the channel?
Ions.
And it so happens that most ion channels are specific for a specific ion. The one of very size, duration, or because maybe there is actually a little receptor on that protein, but it doesn't change configuration. That has to be true without really changing. So you want to think about ion movement and channels. And now we've talked, where are we going to find all that? What tissues do you think we would find, you guys take this knowledge, your head knowledge, what tissues might you expect to find elements of this kind of transport?
Nerves.
Muscle.
Epithelial.
Pardon?
What did you say?
Epithelium, endothelium. Any other tissues you might expect to find something like that? Might you expect to find that in kidney?
I've got kidney.
Would you expect to find that in pancreas? Because what are those tissues made up of? They're made up of cells. And what do cells have?
Plasma
membranes. And so if you can transport across plasma membranes, well, those are the ways. So I'm going to expect to find these things all over the place. And what I learn about and what I think about transport across a a proximal tubule cell, which you talked about in terms of glucose, I'm going to expect to find the same kinds of things in the intestine. I'm going to expect to find the same kind of things all over the place. There may be slight differences by what receptors are and what they do, but the basic processes are the same. So this is another one of our general models. You good with that? All right. Well, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and see what you guys interstitial fluid isn't really plasma, but it's the same as interstitial fluid. So what would you call it?
Extracellular.
Why would you call it extracellular?
Because it's outside the cells.
Very good. All right. What else do you know about? What's a hematocrit? Anybody ever hear of hematocrit with respect to blood? What else do you have?
Percentage of
your
packs.
Percentage of?
Of their...
Okay. So the hematocrit is the packed cell volume of red cells, okay, in relation to the total volume. So I take that blood, I put on centrifuge, spin it down, and at the bottom I get a little column of red cells, and right on top of that are some white cells because they're lighter. I call them buffer coat. And because it's buffer coat. And I measure that height compared to the total height of the column, and that tells me the packed cell volume, packed red cell volume, or the hematocrit. How many of you heard those terms before? No? Good. Okay. Now what should you have recognized from this? I asked at the beginning, who read something about blood? And two people raised their hand. And all during the rest of the conversation, those two people kept their mouths shut. You notice that? They were tested. But you came up with a whole lot of stuff that you know about blood, don't you? There's a whole lot of information. Some of that information, conceptually, we modify the words. So, not all. What I'm trying to get you to recognize is that I can talk about just about anything here. And you have some information. Not always good. Not always the best. You have that information. So, when you want to think about when you come to a new thing, you want to think about what you know and what you don't know. So, now I expect, as we talk about serum and plasma, go ahead, somebody know what that is. Talk about a hematocrit. Well, that's what we do with that. talking about plasma, you recognize that whatever is in the plasma is in equilibrium with the other extracellular fluid. So when we talk about that, we're going to say there are two components, two fluid compartments in the body, and those are
extracellular
fluid and intracellular fluid. Okay, good job. Any questions about any of that?
I have a question.
Sorry? Yep.
Regarding the diagram that you drew up there, one side you said there's formed elements. Is there a name for the other side there?
I guess not formed elements. Elements are, I guess.
Preformed?
I don't know if they're preformed. Because preformed implies that they're going to be formed. So I guess I would call formed elements and not formed elements.
Now that you see where it is, how many people have looked at it already? show you.
Yeah, honestly, I thought this would take a week.
How are we supposed to know what we're, how far to read ahead if we're behind?
How far should we read ahead if we're behind?
Yeah.
Well, each one of those boxes on the schedule, on the tentative schedule, on Monday and Wednesday, is assumed to be a two-hour block. And the ones on Tuesday is assumed to be a three-hour block. So you can look and say, okay, where are we? And if the next day is 2 hours, you say, okay, I can get some idea of where we should go. Am I going to expect you to have a... Or you can always make sure that you're one day ahead. Sometimes that's a little confusing. But am I going to always expect you to have to the exact thing we're doing? I'm going to expect you, especially if we're behind, to have previewed what we're behind on. And if we're moving forward at a faster rate, then I won't expect everybody to have done everything. In the general way. But you need to be honest with me so I know what we want to do. So why are we doing this activity?
Talk about excitable cells.
Why are we going to do this exercise one? Why are we going to do this activity?
To help provide,
a conceptual framework for discussing membrane potential.
Outstanding. Now, how difficult was that to find? What did she do?
I read it.
She read it. She found the thing that says purpose, and then she read it. I would suggest that that's a good strategy to find out why we're doing things. Because otherwise you have this very nebulous kind of thing that... So now we have to decide, if that's the purpose, what is a membrane potential? Anybody have any idea what a membrane potential is? The voltage across the membrane. All right. So what a membrane potential is, really, is a membrane potential difference. So if I'm going to calculate a difference in a membrane, I have how many options for that calculation? How many options do I have? If I want to measure... Megan says three. What are they?
The excitable, or no, the steady state when it's not equilibrium, in equilibrium, or
In each of those cases, if I measure the membrane potential, those are three situations where I might have different membrane potentials. My question was, if I'm going to measure the potential difference across the membrane, what are my two options for doing that measure? Intracellular, extracellular, vice versa. So in English, what that means is I could look from the inside to the outside, or I could look from the outside to the inside. Right? The convention that we will always use whenever we're looking across a membrane or across the wall is always from the inside to the outside. Inside minus outside. If we're looking across the wall, we're going to call that transmural. Why do we call it transmural? Because it's across the wall. Trans means across, and mural means the wall. So the convention is always to go from the inside minus the outside. Okay. And what is it, you think, that's causing this? But I forgot what you said about potential. You said? voltage. And what is it that is responsible for voltage? Or what is voltage associated with?
Ions.
Ions. And what is it about the ion that the voltage is associated with?
Charge.
Difference in charge.
Okay? So when we're talking about a membrane potential difference, we're talking about a difference in charge between the inside and the outside. That make sense? Follow with me. Now, he's going to read the story. Make sure that you ask if you don't understand. Susan is a fifth grade science teacher who designed the game to help her students learn about the mass and detail model. What we talked about the other day. The rules of the game are given below. And you might want to draw a little picture of this, a little diagram of this, piece of scratch paper to follow on. The game begins with a group of boys and a group of girls standing on each side of a fence. On one side of the fence there are
girls,
and on the other side of the fence there are
boys.
Yeah. 100 boys are on the east side of the fence, and 10 boys are on the west side of the fence. So they're not all one or the other. There's some boys on both sides, and some girls on this side. But in this case, 100 boys are on the east side of the fence, and 10 boys are on the west side of the fence. 100 girls are on the west side of the fence, and 10 girls are on the east side of the fence. Now, I'm not going to tell you how this is done, but there are automated energy-expending turnstiles in the fence that keep the ratio of boys on the two sides of the fence nearly constant. So, there's always going to be 10 times more boys on the east side than the west side, and 10 times more girls on the west side and the east side. Therefore, if in fact they have a path, they can move across and get part of the way, and it's going to change some things, but fundamentally, that ratio is going to stay the same. This is a very, very important point. And when we start talking about membranes and ions, we're going to find that the numbers of ions that are there compared to the number of ions that are moving across the fence, the number that are there is huge, compared to the number that we need. So that simple model will work for you, even though it doesn't seem intuitive. Okay? So the automated energy-expending turnstiles in the fence that keep the ratio of boys on two sides nearly constant, to keep the ratio of the girls on two sides nearly constant. That is, concentration gradients of boys and girls on the respective sides of the fence remains essentially constant. The number of boys or girls moving from one side to the other is very small compared to the total number of boys and girls on each side of the fence. Now, here's a critical piece. Each boy and each girl carries a lightsaber. Or words. The lightsabers are identical, and they impart a fixed amount of energy to the person carrying it. Okay? Is that acceptable? Now you see everybody's got a lightsaber. All right. The fence has a variable number of gates labeled boys or girls through which the children can move from one side to the other side of the fence. Boys can only move through gates labeled boys, and girls can only move through gates labeled girls. Got that piece? The game begins when the teacher presses buttons and opens the number of gates. At that time, the boys and girls will be moving through the gates along their respective energy gradients until the next movement of lightsabers. Boys and girls, the next movement of lightsabers through the fence is zero. boys and girls depends on respective concentration gradients of boys and girls, as well as the energy gradient resulting from the concentration of lightsabers on each side of the ranks. Who has questions about the game? Okay.
So are the gates different from the turnstile?
The gates are different from the turnstile. The turnstile is an automated thing, so when a boy gets to the inside, he's made sure that the ratios of the ratio of the concentrations is in the center. And the gate is what he actually travels through the membrane with, down a passive gradient.
Do they travel with the lightsaber through the turnstile?
They do. Everybody hear the question? The question was, do they travel through with the lightsaber to the turnstile? They always have lightsabers. Other questions? Think you have an idea what's happening? All right. For each of the states below, predict how the number of lightsabers on each side of the fence will compare to the number of lightsabers on the east side, compared to the number of lightsabers on the west side of the fence when there is no longer net movement of lightsabers through the fence. So take this in a stepwise fashion. Think about the kind of gradients that are going to cause movement, and tell me what happens when Susan initially opens the equal number of boy and girl gates. Talk about it for about a minute or two, and then I'll ask you. I want to know if there will be, I guess the easy way to say it, I want to know if there will be an accumulation of lightsabers on one side or the other of the fence if there are an equal number of boys' gates and girl gates open.
There are automatic energy equipment turns out to keep the ratio of boys and 2 cents nearly constant, to keep the ratio of girls nearly constant.
Yes,
right. Right? So, we can assume that every time they're going to keep the
turns
out,
just keep the concentration of boys and girls.
A concentration of boys and a concentration of girls stays
constant. So,
everyone has a lightsaber.
Too many boys will go to the girls' side, and they're going to stop letting boys across that way.
That means that, one goes in and one comes out.
There has to be something I don't get, because if that turnstile constantly just keeps them where they're supposed to be, how does anything change at all?
Well, it changes if you look at it 1 second, but that
right.
Happens over time, it doesn't change at all. Yeah. I think, I don't know what else there is to get.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, how instantaneous are the turnstiles?
Well, it says nearly, it doesn't say completely.
What?
Right. Oh, that's the key. Right. So you're looking at a very small sort of change, but
one guy gets over, and then for a second you could have one more guy on that side.
Two boys can swap, but two girls can swap.
That's really hard to remember.
So both gates are open right now. Let's just see if they boys are going to go on the girls' side.
Are the gates same as the turnstiles?
I don't think so.
No, they're not. That's what Sean asked.
It's a big
gate. Yeah, I don't know.
Will there be an accumulation of lightsabers on one side or the other?
No.
No, why not?
Because steady state ratios.
Now, you have to realize that these are pre-incubated boys and girls. So there's no other kinds of attractions between them.
They're actually repelled, right?
No. They just don't care. So why do you think there's not going to be any accumulation? What side of the lightsaber. Because the concentrations have to stay the same on both sides. Is that why?
Well, then the numbers have to stay the same on both sides if the concentration stays the same.
Because for any either given side, the inflow and the outflow is the same.
Why is the inflow and outflow the same?
Turnstile.
It made sense before I said it, but then I forgot.
Wait, I can't hear.
The turn. See,
yeah.
The turnstiles maintain the ratio.
Okay.
The lightsabers are identical.
Right.
So let's change the numbers. Let's say that there are a million boys on the one side and 100 boys on the other side. And a million girls on one side and 100 girls on the other side.
Oh, because it's the equal number of gates.
Ah. She says it's an equal number of gates. And so if you think about movement of girls, what's going to cause the girls to move from one side to the other? The girl gate doesn't cause us to move. What causes us to move? The gradient causes us to move. Which gradient is it?
The lightsaber.
It's the girl gradient. What's going to cause the boys to move across? The boy gradient. And if the gradients are the same, and the number of gates are the same, the boy going across ends up waving at a girl going across, and the lightsabers stay the same. So let's complicate the issue a little bit. Now let's say that Susan opens four times as many boy gates as girl gates. Now what's going to happen? Will there be an accumulation of lightsabers?
Yes.
Yes. You don't like it.
Because the driving force is green. So even though you have more gates open, that just means the boys can get around the green faster, and they'll be done. And girls will just take longer to go down the green.
I agree with that, but I don't think that I might have. I don't
know. Oh,
really,
I'm sorry. Who said
I'm
it?
I'm happy to defend the
No, I, who said it? Somebody said it. I wonder what they're thinking. Somebody said, I heard from this side of the room that I heard from Rhea that.
What's that?
There would not be an accumulation.
I didn't say that.
Then I heard from somebody that would be.
There's greater inflow in there and less outflow, so there's going to be a continuous buildup. I don't see how that's going to balance out, because even if the turnstiles are making sure the gradients are right, you always have that continuous net movement that's greater on one side.
Well, let's see what happens. We have the boy going to here. And there are more boys going to there, and there's a girl getting through here. In our hose in our hose model, why are there more boys going through here than girls going through here? Because there's less resistance. When we talk about ions and stuff, we're not going to talk about resistance, though. We're going to talk about conductance. Conductance is the reciprocal of resistance. So this has less resistance or more conductance. This has more resistance or less conductance. And when we're talking about conductance, that's the number of molecules. Okay? So this is very interesting, because what are these boys carrying?
Lightsaber.
What's the girl carrying?
Lightsaber.
So when the boy gets beyond here, halfway, what's the concentration of lightsabers over here? Over here. It's greater because there aren't as many girls coming over here. So the boys get to the middle faster than the girls get to the middle, and there ends up to be accumulation of lightsabers over here. Now, what forces are pushing the girls that way? The Earth gradient and the lightsaber gradient. Okay. What is causing the boys to move from here to here?
More gates open.
The boy gradient?
More gates
open. And the lightsaber gradient. But the lightsaber gradient is doing what to the boys?
Pushing them the other way.
It's slowing them down, right?
Oh, crap.
So now what we see is that I'm going to get some point where there's no net movement across this fence. Then this boy gradient, and the movement of mind and movement of kids on the basis of that, is balanced by the forces slowing this movement down and speeding this movement up. And as a result of that, I'm going to end up with an accumulation of lightsabers on that side. And so if this is, which side do you want to be the inside?
Girl side.
Girl side is the inside. This is the outside. Is the membrane potential, is the fence potential for lightsabers positive or negative?
Positive.
Girl.
Positive. Why?
Inside minus outside.
Because there's an accumulation here. There are more positives here than there are here. And I said inside versus outside. Make sense? Okay.
No.
So, let's look at the next one. The next one says that now I've reversed this and I've opened more of the girl gates than the boy gates. So what they told me is that initially, there's going to be more girls going through here and boys coming through here carrying lightsabers. As a result of that, as soon as this gets about halfway through, there's going to be more lightsaber energy in this half and that half to slow these down to help push these through. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's what it says. So now for Monday, Monday now, look at exercise 2 and look at exercise 3. And we're going to change the boys and girls to sodium and potassium ions, lightsabers and positive ions. Try to work that out, and we'll talk about that later. See you later. Don't forget your name tag.